Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, my dear friends, fans, colleagues, no matter where you are and when you're listening, welcome back to Voices of the Sacred Feminine podcast. This is your host, Karen Tate, and if you're listening live, well, you don't need a clock. You know it is 11 a.m. Pacific time, and it is Wednesday. And, you can all, whether you catch this directly from Blog Talk or not, we are now on Spotify, Amazon, Google Podcasts, Apple, and there are 12 years of archives available at the Blog Talk site. If you would like to go back and listen to past shows, they're great. Well, and you know, and I'm biased, but I think I'm telling you the truth. And you know what? They are just as relevant today as they were when we first recorded them, because so many of the topics, you know, the cultural topics, the societal topics, the religious topics, the spiritual topics, you know, things have only gotten worse out there in the world, and the things we talked about, you know, over the years, you know, that information we shared is still helpful. And I would like to hear from you if you have any show ideas, interview ideas, if you even if you want to run some commercials about your work here. And if there's anything you believe that would make this show better, don't hesitate to contact me via my website, Karen Tate. And I want to just give a shout out to the artist Celia. That was her music I was playing this morning to start the show, and that particular cut is called Meta Prayer, Meta Prayer. And today my guest is Tom Quinn, and our topic is Christianity and politics. Certainly something that is in the news today, without a doubt. But I quickly want to tell you just a bit of housekeeping, a bit more before we jump into the chat that I know is going to go deep and long. If you were looking for the show last week with Robin Korak about Demeter and Persephone, and, you know, those archetypes and that mythology and spirituality, I was not able to do the show. Robin's father went into hospice unexpectedly, and we had to cancel, but we will reschedule. So you will get to hear her just at a later date. So let me, you know, focus now on today's show, but I wanted to let you know that you know, you will still be able to hear that show in the future. So my guest today, Tom Quinn, I'm so honored to have him with me. He's a twice Emmy-nominated writer-producer who spent 22 years making documentary programs for Discovery Channel, History Channel, BBC, and others. His shows include Disney's archaeological adventure series, Expedition Unknown, which I love, by the way, as well as documentaries covering exotic cultures, world history, urban legends, conspiracy theories, and religious cults. He's also a produced feature screenwriter, and he's worked for a decade as a LA-based film critic, a story analyst for major Hollywood studios, and a celebrity interviewer. Tom is originally from New Jersey. He has an MFA from the American Film Institute, and today works as a freelance writer for print and YouTube. And a few years back, Tom turned his humorous brand of skepticism toward the Bible to produce the factual and funny book titled, What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus? That's kind of an irreverent history of Christianity, written as an argument against the growing religious fundamentalism in American law and politics. Tom, welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I think this is such a relevant topic Tom. But I have to ask you first about your title of your book, What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus? Tell me, what does that title mean?
Well, it actually comes out of an experience that sort of launched my decision to write the book, which was when I was in college, you know, like a lot of young folks, I was a spiritual seeker and tried everything from Buddhist chanting to transcendental meditation to what have you. And shortly after college, I started to concentrate on traditional Christianity because a party buddy of mine from Florida actually converted. And it was such a striking difference to see the difference in behavior. He was what we used to call a Jesus freak, very glassy-eyed with the spirit. And he invited me down to Florida to a Christian revival fair. And there were rides and, you know, people, you know, preaching about how Jesus had saved their marriages or healed their wounds or warned them off liberal congressmen or wherever he did. And among the things they had for sale there were little tchotchkes, including a hand-sized portrait of Jesus made of chocolate. And so I thought, what do you do with a chocolate Jesus? Do you work your way up the legs or go right for the halo? Do you share it with 12 friends as the last dessert? Is it like the Eucharist where it turns into the flesh of Christ when it hits your lips? And if it does that make it okay for a low-carb diet? So they were dumb questions, but it got me sort of on the trail of humorously questioning a lot of fundamentalist Christian ideas.
I get it. Well, you know,
it came out of that.
Go ahead. Oh, okay.
No,
well, you know what
I
thought.
It all came out of that.
Okay. Well, you know what I thought, and of course, it you know, you obviously explained it. I was thinking it somehow referred to this mistaken idea that I grew up with as a Catholic, because we always saw Jesus as blonde-haired and blue-eyed, whatever picture we looked at. And I thought, well, maybe the chocolate Jesus is actually the Jesus that has skin color of someone from the Middle East, like he was supposed to come from the Middle East, and you know, it was kind of like, well, gee, if you've grown up thinking he's blonde haired and blue eyes, what do you do when you find out his skin color is actually brown?
I've heard that alternative idea of the title. It's not bad, but that wasn't the original reason. Although I do agree with the sentiment that we did grow up with the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus. Not a lot of guys like that knocking around first century Palestine, I don't think. And so I think that, it's certainly noteworthy that people interpret it that way. I guess it has a double meaning then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm disturbed, quite frankly, by what I'm seeing today in the news, because I feel like, you know, Christianity is kind of a, and this isn't, God, you know, I know this is going to sound like Christian bashing, and I don't mean to. I mean, I'm a former Catholic, right? I mean, I call myself a recovering Catholic, and I know a lot of Christians don't even consider Catholics Christians. But, I mean, I looked at Catholicism, even though I grew up in it. When I became an adult, I feel like I used critical thinking. You know, I saw all the pedophile priests. I learned about the doctrine of discovery that the Pope used to, you know, give explorers come into new worlds, hundreds of years ago, the license to just steal land from the heathens, you know, these people who weren't white, who weren't Christian. All of the, you know, the misogyny, the sexism, the, you know, making women second-class citizens. And I said, hey, wait, you know what? This doesn't sound like Jesus's love to me. And I also came to think about, you know, here we have this Jesus on the cross, and I went to Catholic school all my life, you know, and we learned that, oh, Jesus died for your sins, and look how he suffered and sacrificed. You want to emulate him. And I really started thinking, wow, what a pitch. Because if you teach kids from a young age that you want to suffer and sacrifice like Jesus did, you're grooming them to be abused. You know, you're grooming them to sort of take whatever whoever, you know, the male that's in power, usually the male authority figure, you're grooming them to just accept misuse and, you know, domination and submission. It feels like a strategy, and it's working. And I don't know, I just wonder, does any of that resonate with you?
Well, yeah, it all resonates with me. What we have is a movement, and it's not most Christians. Most American Christians are, you know, the kind that we usually think of. My mother was Catholic, my father was Protestant, and, you know, they're very moderate, average, people. They were not salvation happy. And most Americans, I think, see most American Christians are like that. Like an example is most American Christians believe that women should have abortion rights, but there's a very vocal and activist minority that doesn't think so, and they are part of this whole, you know, right-wing conservative religious movement, and they are trying basically for minority rule. I think one of the reasons why you're getting these shrill reactions, everything from reversing Roe versus Wade to attempts now to limit contraception and other things, is because they're losing the battle in the popular culture. You know, gay marriage is accepted. People are accepting trans people more often. We're moving in a social progress in that direction, and they don't like it, and they're losing, and so they have to get in there and do what religions normally do, which is to pass laws that force its edicts down people's throats and expect obedience. You know, religion is not about expressing your personal self. It is about sitting up straight and, you know, polishing your shoes and listening to what the pastor says. So
right.
I definitely think that there is a dangerous movement in this country because people are uninterested in the American idea of separation of church and state. They want to go back to the age-old idea that our religion is right and only just governments are based on our religion, and therefore you know, we get to take our religious beliefs and make them the law of the land because we know God best.
Well, and it disturbs me, you know, Tom, and I wonder if you have an answer for me why this happens. The media, I mean, of course, I don't expect Fox News to say the truth about anything, but when we're talking about MSNBC, and until maybe recently CNN, until they went, you know, more right, and I don't know, NPR, the other sort of, I think, reasonable news outlets. Look at the Supreme Court. I mean, we are having that religion shoved down our throat. Nobody talks about how separation of church and state is being violated. Nobody utters the words that we're having this brand of Christianity shoved down our throat. I mean, you might see it when you read the signs of people who are out there protesting, but it's like the messengers, you know, the news media, they are not calling these people out for who they are. And that feels like a mistake to me. I wonder what you think. What do you think about that?
I think a lot of reporters are not particularly religious people. This is probably not a shock to anyone. They tend to be very worldly people. They got to dig out their stories and, you know, they have to do a hard scramble to do their job. And I think that because they're not particularly religious people, they don't fully understand the nature and depth of this particular movement. I think they do, as you say, underestimate it. They regard it as, oh, well, there's always these, you know, sort of noisy, crazy, ultra-Christians who want to do outrageous things. I think that the ruling against abortion has been a bit of a wake-up call. But I think that generally reporters don't know enough about it because whenever they question evangelicals, they never seem to ask the right questions. They ask questions where they don't seem to get it. And I think they also want to avoid, networks want to avoid alienating large swaths of the population, so they don't want to link bad behavior to a specific religion, and partly because not all Christians think the same, obviously, but they want to, you know, avoid just alienating, you know, TV networks are in business. They don't want to alienate their audience. And so they don't want to do that unnecessarily by blaming religion. And I agree with you that I think we do. I think we have to name it as the nature of these particular faiths. You know, people freak out about Sharia law. Well, you also want to freak about fundamentalist Christian law.
Right. Yeah, because they're just, you know, the Christian version, you know, in so many ways. And, I mean, you know, I don't think I heard once that Mike Pence was a Dominionist. And, you know, the Dominionists have these seven mountains that they want to conquer, and it's basically those seven mountains are all parts of our society, culture, you know, education, government, the news media, entertainment field, all of these different things. And they're basically saying they want to, you know, take over all of these areas and enforce their beliefs. You know, that kind of sounds like world domination to me, or at least country domination, if you will. And nobody was afraid of him being in the White House.
No, no. Well, they didn't make us think about Dominionists. They knew he was very pious, which, by the way, the fact that fundamentalists are not lining up behind Mike Pence and they are lining up behind Donald Trump tells you something about where our Christian fundamentalists are these days, and what they're really about, as opposed to being about pious Christians. They're much more about their phenomenon that exists in countries all over the world, which is there's always 10 or 15 or 20% of the country that is very nativist, xenophobic, racist. You know, our faith, our religion, our tradition is right, and everybody else who's different than that is progressively wrong. And, you know, you would think that they would flock to a guy like Mike Pence, who would be their guy. And instead they're flocking to a New York billionaire because he's fueled by the same kind of resentment that they feel. And I think that that's what motivates them mostly is, you know, much like the Christians in ancient Rome, they didn't like the fact that Rome was uninterested in the religion early on. And they believed that all other governments were evil. And the book of Revelation was really written at a time when that was the prevailing thought. And what is it? What's the book of Revelation? It's about a big diatribe against the destruction of Rome and the destruction of the world, and everybody's going to be dead except us good Christians. And in fact, at the end of both the Old Testament and the New Testament, there is a vision of a one-world government under God or under Jesus. So the one-world government that they often complain about and are fearful of is precisely what they're going after, as long as it's their one-world government. And when you told me just this moment here about the seven mountains they want to climb and taking over key industries, it sounds a lot like that forgery that was written 100 years ago called The Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion, which was a conspiracy theory book written to say that Jews were out to take over the world by conquering these particular professions. Now, it turns out that was a Russian forgery pretending to be notes from a Jewish meeting about the taking over the world, but it's a very popular and influential forgery. Everybody from Henry Ford to Adolf Hitler believed it, and it fueled a lot of anti-Semitism in the 20th century. And this sounds like the same thing, only they're taking it seriously. They think that this is really a plan to run the world. And they are, as you say, there is some success in it. They are achieving minority rule through the Republican Party by controlling certain state legislatures and literally taking away constitutional rights. And they're not making a secret of it.
Well, and God, there's so much there I want to unpack. Let's kind of backtrack a little bit. You know, our top issue today is abortion rights. Just to set the record straight, what does the Bible say about abortion?
It says absolutely nothing. That is one of the incredible things. You would think in 1,000 pages of Scripture, given how important abortion is in the mind of so many fundamentalists or evangelicals today, you'd think somewhere in there there'd be a clear statement banning the practice. And in fact, there's nothing. It's never called a sin. It's never called an abomination. It's never called killing. It's never called murder. It's never called anything bad. And the fact is, it never says that life begins at conception either. And what they what the argument you usually get in response is, well, the Bible is pro-life. You know, it's up with life, and they'll give you all kinds of quotes about God saying we should cherish life. And it absolutely is pro-life. Everybody is pro-life. Nobody, you know, that's not a special achievement. Everybody's pro-life. The issue is not whether or not you're pro-life. The issue is, what is a human fetus? Is it a human being, or is it something less? If you think it's a human being, then terminating it is obviously murder. If it's not a human being, then it isn't. And so the question is an egg a chicken? Is an acorn the same as a tree? And by bringing this up, they try to cast it as if it's a life thing, when in fact people who are in favor of abortion rights are not anti-life. They simply see a fetus differently than people who are in abortion.
Right, and at the same time, you know, they talk so much about freedom, but they don't stop and think, well, what are the freedoms that may be curtailed for a woman if she's forced to carry the rapist baby to term, you know, economically, actually, educationally. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, the only place in the scripture that really brings up, you know, it's all about what is a fetus. And the only place that gives us really insight in the Bible as to what a fetus is supposed to be is one Old Testament law in the book of Exodus, Exodus 21:22. And it says that if two men are fighting, if they're contending, and a pregnant woman is caught up in the fight and is caused to miscarry, that a fine must be paid. But a few passages later, it says, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. If you cause the woman to die, it's the death sentence. So if you cause a mother to die, it's capital punishment. If you cause her fetus to die, it's a fine, like a parking ticket. Two radically different punishments for what are apparently two radically different crimes, because you're killing two radically different things. That is the pro-choice view. And since the rest of Scripture is silent on how we should view the unborn, you have to say that the Bible is, on balance, pro-choice.
Right, right. That's a good point. I never heard that before. Thank you. So this idea of freedom, you know, when evangelicals are asked, you know, what Christian values in America are based on, a lot of times you'll hear them say freedom. Do you think freedom, you know, in light of, you know, what we know about their teachings and even abortion, that freedom is a Christian value?
No, it's not, certainly not. It's freedom to be a fundamentalist Christian is kind of their concept, but it's not free to be anything other than that, it seems. Freedom is not a priority in the Bible or in Christian teaching, that is political freedom, because Jesus was not a political philosopher. I like a lot of what Jesus said. I think the world would be better off if we all lived by his teachings. But a lot of the evangelicals we're talking about don't seem to be, you know, aware of his teachings, and they seem to have attitudes that are completely at odds with them. Freedom is one of those values that is ascribed to Christianity, but it really, Christianity doesn't really deserve much credit for it, except to the extent that the fight for Christians to have their own faith, you know, worship in the open, that is certainly a fight for freedom. But that's only really the way freedom becomes a priority. It's not a priority in the Bible. When the Israelites bitched to Moses while they were wandering the Sinai in the 40 years of in the wilderness, they were gobbled up by the earth or hit with a plague. When Job complained about his misfortunes to God, he got a tongue lashing that, you know, you could hear from Jerusalem to Alpha Centauri. And while Jesus may have famously said, "The truth shall make you free," he was not talking about political freedom, free speech, free press, all that. he was talking about the freedom of the soul from sin, which is something you could have in prison. So again, he wasn't a political philosopher. He's a religious philosopher.
Right.
And so, you know, and then, you know, the proof of this is that when the philosophy of Christianity became the dominant religion of the Middle Ages in Europe, there was no free press. You couldn't own a Bible in the early days. There was no free speech. That only meant you could be a heretic. The pre-thinking was seen as a bad thing. And so the American Revolution was really a reaction to this. The founders established free speech and free press and so forth as a reaction to the oppressiveness of royalty and the church and their joined-at-the-hip censorship of free speech. That's why the First Amendment says no law recognizing an establishment of religion. You know, no law, N-O-L-A-W, no law. And in Scripture, there's no talk about freedom. There's no freedom to choose your faith, certainly. You know, it's you choose highway or it's Yahweh or the highway, I should say. You know, it's either that or eternal damnation. That's not really a free choice. And as I said, the Christian Middle Ages, there's no talk of individual liberty. It was about obedience to the king and conformity with the church. And you certainly weren't free to choose your representatives either.
Right, right. Well, you know, so what do you, you know, where do things stand today with, it seems like evangelicals are against separation of church and state. I mean, if they had their druthers, there wouldn't be such a thing, but doesn't that run counter to the founding fathers?
Well, yes, it does, and they don't believe in separation of church and state. They say, well, you know, other religions can exist, but wink, wink, we really know that the Constitution is based on Christianity, and it isn't. You know, it's in many ways based on a rejection of traditional Christianity. I can go into detail about how that's so.
Well, give us the thumbnail version, and maybe in there, part of the explanation will be, is democracy a Christian value?
Oh, sure. Well, democracy owes nothing to the Bible, because democracy was invented by the ancient Greeks back in ancient Athens around the 4th century B.C. and was up and put into practice for about 140 years, all 400 years before Jesus was born, all before the Bible was written. So the people who created democracy wouldn't know Yahweh from a potato knish. And what it proves is that you don't have to link church and state, because they believed in the gods of Mount Olympus. When America's founders came along and borrowed the democracy idea, they didn't feel compelled to borrow the gods of Mount Olympus. You didn't have to incorporate them as well. They stuck with their own religion, but they, borrowed the democracy idea. Democracy is a secular value, not a religious one, which is one reason why it travels so well. You know, it works in Hindu India, Shinto Japan, Catholic Italy, Protestant England, polyglot America. It works in all these different countries and societies because it is a secular value, and it owes nothing to Christianity. During the Middle Ages, as I said, there was no talk of democracy, and it wasn't until the world got more secularized in the modern world that democracy was revived. And that's because democracy is a form of government that is for a different kind of human being than Christians imagine man to be. The biblical religion says man was born in sin, and therefore he tends towards evil. And therefore, you need a strong church and a strong state to keep all these sinning people on the moral straight and narrow. And that's the kind of government it requires. Democracy has a different theory of man, meaning man and women, and that man is actually the rational animal. The glory of his nature is not faith, but reason. And reason demands freedom, to ask questions, gather information, discuss things, come to any conclusions that you want. And that freedom is the basis of the American system. And it didn't come from a Christian tradition.
So where does that leave us today with you know, the Christian nationalists, it feels like a march toward authoritarianism. I mean, so are you saying that, you know, that Christianity, at least in the fundamentalist sense, not the liberal Christians, that it is more of an authoritarian type of religion? So is there any wonder that they're comfortable with the idea of maybe the loss of democracy that we see threatening us in the future?
Yeah, well, I agree that that's it makes it more comfortable for them to live in that kind of system. Also, the fact that democracy is not on their side. You know, if you ask the majority of Americans to vote on all the issues that they're concerned about, they lose in almost every case. And so they're not interested in what the majority says. So if it requires forcing the majority to conform to the minority, then that's what they're going to do, because they are, warriors for righteousness. And so what they do is presumably correct. But, you know, they're not interested in democratic rule, because democratic rule does not empower their point of view.
And so, you know, we talked a little bit, I've heard you say before that it's, you know, the whole basis of Christianity to a certain extent is like conspiracy theory. That was kind of an interesting take. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, the nature of conspiracy theories, and that is the theories about fictional conspiracies, is basically what's called the paranoid style. And it's something that's been around for about 1,000 years in the Western world. And it's basically the idea that there's some secret society out there to get you, that history is not made, you know, it's not a random series of events and clashing forces and all this sort of thing, that there is, in fact, a grand plan that is unfolding, and that there are secret forces at work pulling the strings and making it all happen. And this is the view that fundamentalist Christianity takes. More liberal Christians think, we're kind of making it up as we go along, and if we just stick with the principles of decency and honesty that Jesus taught us, that, get through life without being a complete crap weasel, you'll earn a place in heaven. Whereas the fundamentalists, are much more strict about it and don't want to have room for individual liberty. And so they concoct conspiracy theories because that's what they're used to doing. They live in a universe where the devil is constantly out there, and they can basically assign the devil to anybody they want, any group, any political party, any country, anything that they don't like. Well, that suddenly becomes an instrument of Satan, and therefore fighting that group is not just fighting a group they disagree with. It's part of the holy cause to bring about God's kingdom. And so democracy doesn't really play a role, which is why, again, when the fundamentalist kind of Christianity dominated the Western world during the Middle Ages, there was no talk of democracy or voting or anything else. They were not interested in your opinion.
Well, and you're kind of talking big picture, but if we even bring that attitude into people's individual homes, you look at how it's the pyramid structure: God at the top, men who speak for God supposedly, and everybody else and everything below them, whether it be the planet or the species on the planet or women, they are there to serve man and God, with man as the authority, everybody else in service to or in submission to. And that's a perfect recipe for patriarchy, obviously. I mean, I feel like patriarchy and this authoritarianism go hand in hand, and it's not just big picture, it's in everybody's individual homes. So you grow your family in this, the man of the house grows the family in this authoritarian environment where the wife submits, the children submit, the father is the ultimate authority. And I don't know, it feels like you are grooming predators and prey. You know, maybe that sounds like hyperbole, but I don't think it is.
I don't quite understand the women who are ardent, you know, advocates of this brand of Christianity. Do they resent women who have jobs, or they resent women who seek positions of power? I don't know. They a lot of them have positions of power themselves to try and impose these ideas. But I just don't think that they're interested in democratic rule. And I think that a lot of times what's happened is we've inherited a lot of the male-dominated attitudes from, you know, what started out as a Bronze Age religion. And so that structure has been, you know, kept intact, and supposedly the modern world is a deviation from that. And so it is a hierarchical religion. I do have to say a lot of religions, not just Christianity, are hierarchical, and they are all dominated by men. That's just been the case since the dawn of time, sadly, and as with governments. And so, you know, Christianity is not uniquely off base with that, unfortunately. That's something common to all faiths. And I have to say also that it's usually the conservative version of a faith that is the one most oppressive to women. You know, there are people who are Islamic who believe that women ought to have the right to do and say whatever they want, as in the Western world. But there are a lot of people who think that is completely inappropriate for women. And it's the conservative side, like in Iran and places like that, that oppress women. And that's the same true with Christianity here. Whatever the religion, it's the more reactionary version of that religion that tends to clamp down on women the hardest. I think in part because the liberation of women and the equality of women is such a new development on a historical scale that, you know, they're not ready for the new. They're certainly not ready for, you know, homosexuality or any of the other social innovations or democracy or free speech or any of the other modern things that we tend to embrace. You know, when they're talking about traditionalism, they're talking about, you know, they're not talking about down home in the 50s. They're talking about the 14th century.
Yeah. And you know, and they're really talking about suppressing people's will, voice, their, you know, you know, who they might authentically be. I mean, I highly recommend the documentary out there right now called Shiny Happy People. It's about the fundamentalist group that Josh Duggar was in, that was on reality TV. You know, the mother, I think, birthed 19 children. And I've interviewed the women who escaped from that church. And those women are told, your role in society is to have babies, and you know, they've told me that, you know, because sex is a sin and it's all about shame, you know, sex can't be a thing of pleasure. So the women are basically raped by their husbands because they don't know, the men don't know any better. The women don't know any better. They have to endure. I mean, they were even showing how to break people's will early. They have something called blanket training, where they'll put a six-month-old baby on a blanket and put a toy that it likes within reach. And every time the baby reaches for the toy, they get slapped until the baby stops reaching. And, you know, and there's corporal punishment for children when they cry. Children as old as, you know, like we're talking about 12-month-old children, you know. I mean, it's insidious. I mean, it's really insidious. So you raise these women who don't know how to say no. In fact, there was a woman on the documentary who said she went to a church conference, and the men and women were segregated into their own dormitories, but some of the men made it into the women's dorm and were, you know, tried to get into their rooms and were crawling into their beds to molest them, rape them, whatever, and they didn't even have the words for resistance. Because for their entire life, resistance was not, you know, something that they learned how to even muster up. You know, that disturbed me.
Well, all this is,
you know,
I think all of this though is sort of like a deep perversion of it all. I don't blame Christianity per se, or certainly not the teachings of Jesus per se. These are cultists. These are fascists, and they use religion as the basis of their fascism. They're not the first to do this. There is a one way that you're supposed to live. It's my way. And, you know, they're like the Amish or the Mennonites in a way, and they believe in a very traditional rejection of modern life. But unlike the Amish and the Mennonites, who live the way they want and live and let live and coexist peacefully with everybody else, these folks are not interested in just being free to live by their medieval way of life. They want you to live by their medieval way of life. And if you turn them down, then they're going to pass laws to force you to live by their medieval way of life. And this is not only un-Christian, but it's un-American.
Right, right. Tom, we need to take a quick break here because I have a word from Joe Carson that I need to share with listeners. But when we come back, I want to ask you, you know, kind of a big question. Is Christianity the solution to America's problems? But first, a word from Joe Carson.
Okay.
This is from Jonathan Nightshade, a Gardnerian high priest of the Whitecroft line, a traditional craft practitioner and researcher, writing about Joe Carson's book, Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Farafaria Path. I love this book. How special this work is and how appreciated. As someone who was young in the 1970s and through the years only found snippets of information on Farafaria, one of the first modern pagan paths, this book comes as an artistic revelation of the core practices of the way of the goddess and gods reborn for the next age of the divine maiden. She has clearly introduced the historical background, philosophy and ritual practices of the joyous wilderness mysteries of the fairy faith, illuminated by the marvelous pagan art of Farafaria's founder, Fred Adams. I was very pleased that the high-quality production of this oversized volume makes it a collectible work of art, as well as a testament to the visionary philosophy of Fred Adams. I feel blessed that I received a copy. I will treasure it and look forward to the next book for more of the deep philosophy and ritual practice of Farafaria.
Celebrate Wildness is a dense, art book quality hardcover book. You can get it for just $45 from the Farafaria website at farafaria.org. That's F-E-R-A-F-E-R-I-A.org.
And while I have your attention, I just want to remind listeners of my new book that's out called Normalizing Abuse. And you can find out more about it on Amazon or at my website, KarenTate.net. And, you know, it asks the question, do you make excuses and rationalize abuse because it's so familiar that you discount it as being normal? And I tackle a lot of different areas where we're actually enduring abuse and exploitation, and we think it's just the way it is rather than calling it out. So, Tom, I think I know the answer to this, but I'd like to hear your version. Is Christianity the solution to America's problems today?
Well, I kind of addressed this in the last chapter of my book, which, to plug it again, is What Do You Do with the Chocolate Jesus? And which you can get on Amazon and Kindle and Audible as an audiobook, by the way. And as far as is Christianity the solution to America's problems, As I said, the world would be better off if we all lived by Jesus' teachings. But Jesus' teachings are voluntary, not mandatory. They're not forced upon you from above. And really, if, you know, it didn't say ancient Rome. Rome was an empire that was declining in its last couple centuries, and that was the time when it became officially Christian, and it became the world's first civil theocratic state in terms of Western religion. And that did not save Rome from ultimately breaking apart and dissolving into the medieval kingdoms. I think as far as today, if you worry about American culture becoming more secular or more diverse, having foreign ideas or a variety of beliefs, then Christianity is the solution. If you worry about America having a threat to democracy or a threat to diversity or a threat to the rule of law, then I think there are certain branches of Christianity that are very much the part of the problem. I think our Constitution is one that is compatible with all religions if they're practiced the way they should be, which is in the life and in the mind and in the hearts of the believer community. I think all religions are incompatible with the Constitution if they are forced upon people against their will.
So, I guess I wonder, with a quarter of the world being Christian, why do you think it's the most popular religion in the world right now? If it's one like some of the others, forcing themselves on people.
Right. Well, a lot of it spread just because it's an appealing religion. I think it's actually up to about a third of the world now. I think it's popular partially because I think they always have the best metaphors. You know, they have the happiest promises. You rise from death. A man sacrificed himself for us out of love. These ideas, we share his blood and we are one with him in body. All of these ideas are appealing ideas, the idea that you can rise from death and live in eternal happiness, and all you have to do is listen to Jesus and be nice to everybody. That's not a tough idea to sell. They basically took the all-powerful God of the Hebrews and made him into a kind of a friendly older brother, you know, and so you can have a personal relationship with God. In the Jewish faith, God is a more distant entity, incorporeal, doesn't have a particular look or feel. With Jesus, he's, your older best friend. He's always there and has your back. I also think that Christianity's benefited from the Enlightenment in that the Enlightenment, which was a rejection of traditional religion-dominated government and more reason-based, rational scientific secular society that we have today, I think it put the Enlightenment basically put Christianity in perspective. It made religion as a choice rather than an all-controlling entity like in Islamic countries. And it made it an option and a personal choice, which is also very appealing. And that way it inherited Enlightenment ideas like democracy and free speech, individual liberty, human rights, tolerance. None of those ideas come from traditional Christianity. These are ideas that came from the Enlightenment. Christianity signed on and so carried them forth. And so it's identified more with those values than it traditionally was. And it's identified more with those values than other religions because those are not, the other religions are not part of the West.
So, you mentioned Jesus. I mean, growing up Catholic, Jesus was all about love. And I don't see, the brand of Christianity we've been talking about today being about love at all. It feels like it's more about oppression and control and domination. What happened to Jesus's love? And, and isn't prosperity gospels just merging Christianity with capitalism?
Well, yes, it is. Well, it turns out there's Jesus and then there's Jesus. There's the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, which, you should love your fellow man as you love yourself and so forth. It's the sort of the benevolent vision of Jesus. And then there's the later Jesus of the cross, which becomes sort of a battle standard. It literally became, a battle standard on shields in the Middle Ages and so forth. And that became sort of the icon of imperial religion. And basically it's part of a long, sad tradition of people having a set of ideas about how things ought to be run and then recruiting Jesus into their mentality to justify what they're doing. So it's like, well, it's not just my opinion of how things ought to be run, it's God's opinion. And so they have Jesus buy into, so conservatives have him turned him into a laissez-faire investment banker who rewards people with high stock values. And, when in fact Jesus was the man who said he should reject the cult of money and it's better to give than to receive, and the love of money is the root of all evil, and so forth. But they can mangle him into whatever it is they want him to say, and that way he becomes this sort of shield that you can't argue against. Whatever their little petty biases or beliefs now becomes the will of God. And so they use it in that way.
Yeah, and if you say God deems it, even if it's just man-made dogma for an agenda, how do you fight that? You know, if God demands it, when, you know, it might be the antithesis of Jesus or God, but you know, you're hearing it from the pulpit, and by God, you know, it must be true.
Well, I think that the pushback on this needs to be more about basic desire for freedom. I think one of the problems with pushing back on the abortion issue, for instance, is too many say, well, if you don't have abortion rights, then women are going to be suffering here, and these are the bad social effects, all of which are completely relevant. But I'd like to go to the basic principle, which is this is a basic attack on individual liberty, which is the cornerstone of our republic. Our government is designed first and foremost to defend each individual's right and freedom to live the way they want and to believe the way they want. And when it comes to what is a fetus, that is a personal philosophical decision that should not be imposed upon somebody against their will. That becomes like the communists, where there's one point of view, everybody has to have it, and it's going to be forced upon you whether you believe in it or not. And that's what justifies it, was the fact that it's part of a grander plan. And what we have to say is that this is a medieval attack on modern freedom.
Yeah.
And
well,
and
you
people,
make me think
to remind people that the era was to remind people that in the Christian era, when the religion did dominate, that there was no mandate for individual freedom, free speech, free press, freedom of electing your officials or anything else. You know, Republicans get up there or others get up there and claim that America was the first country based on Christian values. In fact, all the governments of the Middle Ages were officially based on Christian values and provided no individual liberty at all. The United States formally separated itself from Christianity and from all religions, and that became the cornerstone of our modern ideas of freedom.
Yeah, but they'd like us to forget that and basically rewrite history. You're making me think about gun rights. You know, a lot of conservative Christians are pro-gun. How does gun ownership square with traditional Christian values?
Not too well. I mean, if you look at what Jesus had to say about, you know, force and weapons or whatever, he said, like, you know, all that take up the sword will perish by the sword. Love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Do not resist one who is evil. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him also the left. Judge not that you shall not be judged. It's hard to square that with the mandate of the NRA. You don't use force for any reason whatsoever. You don't even use it for self-defense. I mean, you know, imagine if the day they came to arrest Jesus, he was packing heat. You know, go ahead, make it my day.
Right.
The story would have been very different. And the fact is that there's no justification for using violence for any reason, not even to save your own life. Jesus acted out that, Jesus himself acted on that principle.
Yeah. Well, and I think we talked about this before the show. I don't think we were on the air yet. And I think it would be interesting to hear you share with listeners. Why do you think evangelicals, when they have a choice like Pence, who is an evangelical dominionist, by the way, you know, the news media hasn't picked up on that to warn us, but why do they choose Trump, who, you know, used to be a liberal or at least a Democrat, you know, and we know he's done all of these, you know, con man, blah, blah, blah. How can they in their mind justify Trump over Pence?
they put Trump over everybody because, first of all, he's much more entertaining than any other Republican who's running for office. I mean, he's a stand-up comic of right-wing politics, and there's not too many of those around. So he's fun to go to a rally and rally about. And as I said before, I think it's because he hates the same people that they hate. He resents the same people that they resent. They resent a lot of modern, you know, coastal culture, you know, life in the fast lane, city life, which, by the way, is something that goes through the whole Bible. Ever since, you know, Abraham, cities are always the centers of evil and sin, and it's, you know, God was always found out in the country or out in the desert. And so this is, you know, people in more rural places, you know, find more comfort with that conservative view of Christianity. And I think they flock to Donald Trump simply because he unapologetically voices the things that the same resentments that they have against New York, against L.A., against Hollywood, against, gay people or modern life or big government or whatever. Although Trump is a big government guy and they are becoming big government guys. They believe in theocracy. And I think that's why. I think they just dislike the same people. And Trump is the first one who puts it out there forcefully, and they're just willing to forget all the rest, which I guess demonstrates my principle, which is that they're hypocrites. They decide what they want to believe, and then they use Jesus as the excuse for believing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tom, we're you know, getting toward the end here. In fact, we're a little bit over, but that's okay. What haven't I thought to ask you that you think is important about this subject for listeners to hear?
Oh, I think we've covered it pretty well. I guess, I mean, I do believe that there are advantages that we have to recognize to being deeply religious. Statistically, people live longer. They're supposedly happier. They have a greater sense of a just universe, and they bond as a community. So there are advantages to being religious, and I never try to talk somebody out of their faith. What I do in the book, What Do You Do with the Chocolate Jesus, is to try to underline, okay, if you're going to start passing laws in the name of this faith, then we need to take a good look at this faith. If you're going to start passing laws based on this book, we need to take a close look on the book. And that's why I take people through the whole history of Christianity and chapter and verse through to kind of examine what it actually says versus what people claim it says, and to, you know, make that important difference, and also to underline the fact that we live in a country that's not in the business of enforcing biblical law. The founders were Christians who came up with the Constitution, but Albert Einstein came up with E equals MC squared doesn't mean that's a Jewish formula. It's not the product of Jewish thought. It's the product of scientific thought. And the Constitution is not the product of Christian thought. It's the product of Enlightenment thought. And I think we need to learn more about the Enlightenment, which is something a lot of people don't study in school.
Yeah. Well, and forgive me, I do, you just made me think of another, I think, important question. Have you determined in your mind why so many seem anti-science as well? I mean, even when we were, you know, millions were dying of COVID, you know, they have a problem following the science.
Well, yeah, science has always been a little bit antagonistic towards religion, going back to Galileo and even before. And the fact is that whatever they've decided they want to believe, they're not going to let facts and reason and proof get in the way. Remember, the whole basis of their religion is faith, and faith is belief in the absence of evidence. Faith is what you ask of somebody when you don't have the goods to prove your point. And so they're not, you know, facts are not relevant. And when you can concoct an understanding of the universe that is disconnected to provable facts, it's a small step to say, well, you know, science says evolution is real. Nah, don't believe it. Science says, you know, a 20-week-old fetus is not a human being. Nah, I don't believe it. It's easy to reject science just because anything that doesn't square with the faith is going to be discarded. Thomas Aquinas changed that around, by the way. Thomas Aquinas switched things from the faith comes first school of thought to the reason comes first school of thought, because he thought that if you were rational and scientific, you could prove the existence of God and the authority of the church. Didn't really work out that way, but that's what he thought. And he's the one who really switched us away from the medieval concept of faith over all things to reason. And once reason became the dominant thought way, then you could revive all that ancient Greek knowledge and Roman knowledge and science and so forth and adhere to what reason tells you while still carrying faith in your heart. And unfortunately, there's some people who are not interested in just leaving it there. They want to impose it on the entire social order.
Yeah, I mean, when I realized, you know, they're even against, you know, carbon dating, I mean... I don't know. It just feels all crazy, you know, feels crazy to me. And do you have any advice on someone who really cares, you know, that they're not putting these sorts of people in office to make laws for our country? Is there a way to find out, you know, are they a dominionist? Are they a fundamentalist? You know, is that trapped somewhere? Do you have any idea?
I don't know that it's trapped somewhere, but I don't think you have to necessarily focus it just on the dominionists. That's one group. You have the family on C Street in Washington, D.C., which is another right-wing Christian cult. So there's a number of them out there. And I think you have to sort of put them in the same bucket, which are basically medieval theists or Christian fascists, people who are fervent in their belief in the religion, whatever warped version they believe in, but they're not interested in each person making their own decision. They know best. They're going to impose it on you because this is the proper order of the world. And modernism is not of interest to them. We have to remember that throughout history, you know, secular, rationalist, popular governments are a rarity. You know, what we've done here in the West in the modern world, we are islands in a sea of mysticism and medievalism and religious mythology and so forth. We're the rarity in history. And so it's constantly a pushback status that we have against the natural human instinct to follow strong leaders and believe what they tell us. And, you know, if we just blindly follow, they'll protect us and all will be orderly as God wants.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the reason that some women buy into it, even though they're oppressed, is because they're told, oh, you know, don't worry your pretty little head about any of this stuff. Just go have babies and we're going to take care of you. But, you know, I think that's the deal with the devil.
I was just going to say I agree with you about it. It's a strange mentality that, you know, women would advocate this sort of secondary role for themselves. But I think also it's a lot of the same thing. They watch news that paints a landscape. My bottom line in all this is Fox News is the problem, because what you have is a network that paints an entire world landscape that conforms to this paranoid medieval Christian dominionist kind of view, that there is a grand conspiracy out there. Some say it's, you know, satanic forces. Some say it's just liberals. Some say there's no difference between the two. And that they're all out there trying to, you know, subvert the will of man and, you know, have global pedophile rings and eat babies and, you know, just any incredible stuff that stoners in the middle of the night can think of to horrify Christians. You know, they've got it on the list there of things that are actually happening in the world. And it's when you watch a news network that is unhinged from reality, you get used to that, and you get used to a view of the world that doesn't operate by the real rules, because you have no reference points. You don't know that world. You know a fictional world.
Well, yeah, and I think about, you know, how I still wonder. I mean, look, I value you know, freedom of speech, but, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded room. And how Fox and shows like Fox can get away with continually perpetuating lies that, you know, led to January 6th, that helped Trump, you know, perpetuate the big lie that's actually destroying democracy, you know, that's duping people. I mean, I have friends that think, gee, well, the left is as bad as the right. And I say, well, what news are you watching? Because it's the right that's trying to take everybody's freedoms away, you know, not the left. And, you know, but fear is at the heart of all of it. And I don't know, I guess I wonder, did the Murdochs or, you know, and Ailes and all of these people go into this wanting to take down the country, and they thought they could slowly do it from within, like, you know, is scary, and I feel like, you know, maybe they're succeeding to a certain extent. You know, I don't know, it almost, that feels like a conspiracy to me, but then I think somewhere at the heart of it is it's got to be about the money. You know, it's got to be about the money, but I don't know. It's just this confusing mishmash, you know, in my mind that, you know, did this happen by accident? Was this the plan from the beginning? And how can they allow to be continue to do this? Because they're enemies of the state, you know?
Yes.
I don't know.
Well,
do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, they've created a Frankenstein. I think initially Ailes and all them, basically, they just wanted a right-wing network that told the news the way they saw fit, you know, and not all this liberal press stuff. And so they would see it from a very right-wing point of view. And they started there deliberately, you know, angling the news in a very conservative direction. And I think they just got caught in a right-wing ratchet. You know, the more right-wing and extreme they got, the more popular they got, because the more angry people would be watching. And, you know, they're now in a mode where they're in a constant mode of freaking people out over the latest liberal atrocity. And one of the things that they've succeeded in doing, I think, is equating, you know, when people say, well, liberals, conservatives are all the same, those people are part of the problem. Most of the complaints against the liberals are faux threats. Oh, they want to take away all our guns. Oh, they want to censor us and not let us have free speech. Oh, they want to open the border and let all the hordes in. None of those things are factually true, but every time a Republican opens his mouth, he'll say those things. Whereas things like taking away the right to an abortion or contraception, those are things that the left complains about the right. Those are real things. Those are things that are actually doing. So the fears about the right are genuine things that are really happening. The fears mostly from the left are contrived things they take and they run off the end of the earth and exaggerate it.
I totally agree. And everything comes down to fear. You know, I think fear is at the heart of everything. Fear is at the heart of all the hate. And, you know, when they get a daily dose of it, I mean, I know my husband accidentally got on, you know, he was looking at during COVID, he was looking at purchasing food, you know, to have in the event, you know, if things broke down and blah, blah, blah. And so suddenly Now he's on all of these right-wing emails, and this, I'm just amazed by the stuff he gets every day. You know, it's like it's this whole culture, you know, they're building a whole culture on fear. Yeah. Well, but the emails he gets are beyond that even, you know. I mean, the stuff that they say Biden's going to do or liberals are going to do or, I mean, it's just crazy. And most of the time it's, you know, they're trying to sell ignorant, fearful, uneducated people something they're selling. You know, they're making money off of it. You know, it's become a commodity.
That's Trump's base.
That's
Trump's base, and it is all about the money. With Murdoch and them, it's ultimately all about the money, and there's lots of money in freaking people out over the left, you know, and a lot of people are not really discerning. I have some friends, you know, neighbors here. They're very Christian, and they're true believers and a little bit evangelical. They're not, you know, fascists or anything like that, but they kind of roll with it because they just feel, well, you know, it's just all Christian, so therefore ultimately it's going to be okay. And I think a lot of people, even within the movement who are Christians, don't take these particular activist groups seriously. Or when they do succeed in doing something like banning abortion, it doesn't freak them out because it's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, that's a Christian value. So, you know, what's the heck? What's the problem? It's not a Christian value,
yeah.
But, you know, they're convinced that it is.
Yeah. Well, Tom, thank you for your book because, you know, education, 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 while the right wants to ban books, right? I mean, what side is banning the books and what side isn't banning the books, right? I mean, there's a good, you know, there's a good red flag for you right there. Who wants to keep you ignorant and who wants you to expand
yeah,
your
well,
mind?
I'm glad to see that there's some traditions that are still alive and well.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, thank you, Tom, for the conversation today. Also, you know, thank you for your book, What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus? And as you said, you can find the book at all the usual places.
Yeah, on Amazon. And Amazon.com is the easiest place. And there you can either get the paperback or the Kindle or an audiobook.
And I saw here that you did a humorous talk entitled God Needs Therapy. Is that on YouTube somewhere that listeners might be able to go and hear, or was that just in, you know, in-person sort of a thing?
Let's see. I believe I have it posted on my website, which is trquinn.com. It's my professional site for my producing work. But towards the end of it, I have a number of recordings taken excerpts from my book, and I think I may have the Abraham, a little clip there telling a story from that God Needs Therapy lecture. It's basically what I do is I walk through the Old Testament and psychoanalyze God, showing what insights we have into his personality with each chapter of the Old Testament. And it's kind of half stand-up comedy routine, half history lecture.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm going to go look for it. I think it would be fun and informative, which is what I think you've done today and with your book. So thank you so much, Tom. And, you know, I hope there's a lot of more Emmys in your future.
Well, thank you very much, Karen. I really appreciate it. And let's say with a slight tongue-in-cheek, keep the faith.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I know we went over a little bit, but I think it was worthwhile. You know, no doubt so much of what we said you've been thinking, and now it's just not in your head. You know, other people are talking about it, too. And if you tune in with me next Wednesday, my guest is Arasanya Moon, and our topic is Dancing with Deity, a conversation about heart-led magic. And that about does it for me for today. I just want to remind you, please do go to my website, KarenTate.net. If you've been a believer in my work and a supporter of the podcast, of my books, of my articles, you know, classes that I teach, that sort of thing, you can actually scroll down to the bottom of my homepage and you can buy me a cup of coffee. And that actually helps me continue doing what I do because things like this show, you know, this is not something that I make any money off of. So this is, you know, this is a service to the community. This is not about monetary gain. And it does help to have monetary support from the community in order to, you know, keep putting my energy into this rather than, you know, something else that, you know, might be more lucrative. So with that, I will close the show with my usual closing, Sekhmet, the lion-headed Egyptian goddess. We pay homage to her because she is about strength, courage, tenacity, having healthy boundaries, and teaching especially women to say no, No, hell no. I'm not going to take it anymore without guilt. All right, see you next week, folks. Bye.